in which they were born and reared, we're saying that even though these Jews, we're going to talk about this in a moment, they viewed Jerusalem and the temple as the mother city, yet they viewed their own land, wherever that was, as their fatherland. Why? Because they'd been there a long time. This dispersion went back. You know, there were Jews who had been Jews for a long time. And there had been several generations who had never lived in Palestine. You got this? So that's their motherland, but their fatherland, even the land in which they were born and reared, while for some of them, they have come at the time of their foundation as immigrants to the satisfaction of the founder. That is, they were viewed as having been in these countries from as long as the country had been a country. So what he's saying is that these Jews are everywhere, and he's saying, Philo says, do not think that these Jews are looked upon themselves as immigrants, or as foreigners, or aliens. Oh no, these Jews are Jews, have been, even though they have an alliance and loyalty to Jerusalem and the temple, yet they are not Palestinian. They're just as Egyptian as any other Egyptian. Now, by the way, you see this, of course, in the Ethiopian eunuch, the land he came from, the land of Meroe, was laying on this man, very far south. And he was black, probably, most likely. May not have been. There were Jews who served as administrators in the courts all over the world, so he possibly was not a black man. Doesn't make any difference. Probably was. But the fact that he was Ethiopian didn't mean he was black. What I'm saying. Because the Jews have been in Ethiopia for generations. By the way, do you know that there's a religion in Jamaica called Rastafari? I don't know if we were down there a few years ago. We saw them and they let their hair grow and they had a calendar in their hair. It flies away. They looked upon Haile Selassie as the Messiah, who was the past emperor of Ethiopia. The Haile Selassie claimed to be the direct descendant of David. One of the titles of the Haile Selassie War was the Lion of the Tribe of Judah. And he may have been. Claimed to be directly descended from Solomon. And so we find, so that the Ethiopian eunuch, although he was just probably black, may not have been. He may have been one of these Jews who had been in Ethiopia for a long time. But he's seen as a black Judaism, which goes, but you can trace black Judaism as far back historically as you can trace any other brand of Judaism. See, there's no such thing as a Jewish race, and there never has been. Ku Klux Klan used to learn that. You know, but the purity of race, which is one of the most absurd, it's government grade A inspected, A number one stupidity. For anybody to cry for purity of race, there's no such thing as purity of race for anybody. No, I've never met a white man who was pure. We're not pure. Because everything, Teutonic, Anglo-Saxon, as a trader, and stocks, there's no such thing as pure race. And there's no such thing as Jewish race is a myth. There's no thing as Jewish race. Then the Book of Romans points out that being born of Abraham, or thinking that you were, didn't make you a child of Abraham, never did. You see, when the Jews came out of Egypt, they brought many with the Egyptians with them, who were Hamitic peoples, not Semitic peoples. Remember how the law provided how that they were to be incorporated into the Jewish economy, how they were to be proselyted? And the Jewish proselytes became full Jews, and for generations to come were counted with the tribes. They were not even Semitic. An olive-skinned person, or a white person, has no more claim to be a Jew than any black person. There were black Jews from the very beginning. I don't even know what color Abraham was. Probably he was Semitic, probably, but you see, this talk of race has got to be one of the most historically absurd, foolish notions that men have ever come up with. You go to Jerusalem today, look at the Jews, what do you see? You see everything, from the Mediterranean look to the blonde Nordic. You see everything. There was a story told one time about in Japan, there was Oriental Judaism, it was back very far, this Jew from New York, and he was visiting Tokyo, and he came to Sabbath, and he found a synagogue, and he went in, and they asked him what he was doing, and he said, I came to worship, and they said, these are all Japanese now. He said, oh, you don't look Jewish. See, what we tend to do, we say, well, it looks like a Jew.
very disparaging thing to say. Well, what we're talking about is the Mediterranean stock of Judaism, which came to Europe and to America. There's no such thing as others like the Jews. Following? There's no such thing as the Jewish race. And there never has been. There never has been. What is Judaism? That's a culture. It's a religion, a religio culture. The religion or the culture is both. The one thing it's not is race. And it never has been. I was laughing. Because of the Ku Klux Klan mentality. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. It's pretty hard to malarkey. But anyway, and it was just as true in the first century as it is now, by the way. You know that? You couldn't look at anybody and say it was a Jew. There was no such thing as a Jewish race in the first century. This thing of being born of Abraham's flesh was a myth. It was an idea. It never was a genealogical fact. It never was. Yes.
Did Moses marry what was considered a person from the... they're the black and...
Yes. Although, you see, the ancients, we've got to be careful about that. They thought in terms of nationality, not of race. See, for instance, the prohibition to not marry the Canaanites, the religious prohibition, nothing to do with race. It was
right.
Race. Yeah, well, most of them were Semitic, but they haven't. You see, this idea of thinking in terms of color, for instance,
right.
That was never a part of it. No, nationality or background.
Well, yeah. Jesus was born of Abraham's flesh.
You see, they trace families back, but you see, within these families, they've been married into these families. People of all what we call races have been married into these families and always have been. I'll give you an example. One of his descendants, one of Christ's ancestors, an ancestor to Christ was Ruth. There's a Moabite.
And Rahab.
Yeah. So you got, in other words, they found me from the beginning. People of all groups, all peoples, had married in to the Jewish economy, become part of the families, become full Jews, become, follow me, had come into the tribes. So the fact that a person wore the name Benjaminite did not mean he was genealogically connected to Benjamin at all. It means he could have married into the family somewhere along the line. But you see, by the way, you know that you're not related to anybody. But most people are not related to genetically to their great grandfather anyway. Following as far as carrying a common genetic code, it's all gets diffused anyway. The whole idea of race is an absurd joke. Only one race is the human race. What we call race is a set of characteristics that tend to be dominant when a group marries within itself. Over long periods of time, sometimes it's the color of skin that becomes dominant, sometimes it's the texture of hair that becomes dominant, sometimes it's height that becomes dominant, sometimes it's the shape of the skull that becomes dominant, sometimes it's the color of eyes that becomes dominant. What we tend to do is pass on one of them, the color of skin, and say that's race. And never have been. So, in other words, as soon as a person in one generation, to show you how fixed race is, a person can marry out of race in one generation, that those characteristics aren't dominant anymore, the whole thing is gone. A person will be born of a black skin, or yellow skin, or yellow skin, for 3,000 years, and it's one generation to destroy that look, we call it home, because there's no such thing as race. It's just the human race. Y'all learned that lesson, by the way. We're all Heinz, 57 varieties. And anybody that makes a distinction with race makes that a point of distinction. It's got to be one of the world's great absolute fools. You got to go to school and take lessons on being ignorant. To make distinctions by race. But anyway, that's my lesson on race. It's purely artificial. Purely artificial distinction. Always have been. Well, anyway, so, you got me? We talk about, what's a Jew? If you think in terms, it's one of the reasons, it makes me appreciate what Paul said when he says, being born of Abraham, and who could ever prove they were born of Abraham, had nothing to do with it anyway. It was not of Abraham's flesh, it was of Abraham's faith that made a Jew. You know, it's happening. So the point is, in other words, what I'm saying is, let's assume that the Ethiopian eunuch was black, and he probably was, but you can't be sure. Often people are astounded. There was a black Jew, as if that were an exception. I'm simply saying it wasn't, and surprising by the first century. By the way, there's a black Judaism. You go to New York and find a black Judaism, one of the first synagogues. And there are many strains of it, different divisions of it. Let's trace their Judaism all the way back to long before the time of Christ. Yes.
I was wondering about the teaching that we were studying the other day about when Abraham paid a tribute to Melchizedek, it was saying that the Aaronic priesthood was inferior to the Melchizedek's priesthood because the descendants of Abraham were in fact paying tithes to Melchizedek.
What I'm saying is it's a theological concept, not a genealogical fact. See, first you can trace your, theoretically, see, everybody in the world can trace their genealogy back to Adam. Don't tell me it's being, you know, what's the direct descendant? You can start isolating it, you see. It's a theological concept, not a genetic concept. That's why we appreciate the fact that the New Testament exposed the whole thing anyway. Not anything anyway. God has no respect for persons. Well, anyway. what I'm saying is that there was no such thing as a Jewish race if you meant you could look at a person and tell they were a Jew in the first century. You know what I'm saying? Appearance. His Hellenistic Judaism was very old. But like I say, even back in the days of Moses, a large number of people that came out were, look at this, a large number of people came out of Egypt were Egyptians, came with them, were Hermetic people, dark skinned. The Canaanites were Hermetic peoples, married into them. One of the big crimes, one of the reasons they were allowed to be conquered by Assyria and Babylon was that they had intermarried religiously. They didn't marry with the Canaanites. The objection was not racial, it was religious. The fact is, they didn't marry. And they had married with the Assyrians and all their peoples, and that was just. You somehow just, if you could think in terms of race, by that you mean appearance, or a certain combination of dominant genetic traits, then you simply don't know what's going on. It's never a factor. Genetically now, you got what I'm saying? I think the descent of Abraham is a theological concept. Yes.
You say you couldn't really look at a Jew and tell the difference. How, you know, like, there's always a conflict between, you know, the Jews and the Samaritans. How would they tell the difference between them?
Another dress. They look the same. In the ancient world, certain countries today where there's really racial. There's all kinds of, not in Jamaica, we were in Jamaica years ago. There was no racial prejudice, there was all kinds of economic prejudice. They didn't care what you looked like, they didn't care what you had. They looked down, you were lower class, it had nothing to do with color. They didn't marry you, the most beautiful people you could possibly imagine. Some of the strangers looking at them, too. People with pinky hair and yellow skin. Some of the most beautiful people in the world. You go to countries like Brazil, some of the South America, where they have no concept of religious or racial prejudice. Where everybody marries everybody, never thinks anything about it, as far as race is concerned. And you get the most beautiful people in the world. That was an ancient world. You got that? In the ancient world, talking about other peoples, these were national cultural distinctions, not appearance, following. Nothing to do with the color of skin, or the color of your eyes, the texture of your hair, nothing to do with that. Okay, now. I'm not going to finish that, see that. What I want us to see is, to really understand, is that there was a Judaism, now listen to me, there was a firmly entrenched, very ancient, very highly developed Judaism, which we are calling Hellenistic Judaism, which was very much Judaism, but it was very different from the Pharisaic Judaism of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which is Jesus confronting. Very important to the history of the church. nothing to do with the appearance of a person. They were simply, they were Jews by their culture, what they believed. Now, they, Philo says they're all over the world. Cities can't contain them, so many of them. And by the way, this was the majority of Judaism. I talk about this because often people, because Matthew, Mark, Luke, there's four books in the Gospel, only one is the book of Acts, people think that they think of Jews, the Jews of the New Testament, they think of the Jews of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? And we talk about the Jews in those terms. They were a very small minority. The Hellenistic Jews meant the large majority. Now, these Jews spoke, they maintained a bond, they maintained their separateness from paganism. They had nothing to do with the silly, gross paganism of the world. They maintained a bond with the temple in Jerusalem. We just read from Philo. That is, what they would do is, well, what's the clearest example in the New Testament of a Hellenistic Jew who maintained his bond with the temple? They've been to Jerusalem all the way. It's a long, hard journey. But they would come, and of course we see the day of Pentecost, people from all over the world. See? Well, what did they come for? Come for the feast. They would come for Pentecost, come for Passover, and stay for Pentecost. So the Jerusalem was filled on these feast days. People all over the world. Even though, now note this, these were not people coming home. These were not expatriates. These are people who, for many generations, for the most part, who for generations had never lived in Palestine. They're of all colors, we call color. They're from everywhere. Palestine was not home, but it was sort of like this was the holy city. You came for, you know, one, at least once in your life, you had to come to the holy city and be there for the Passover. We have something of that today in all the Holy Land trips. Something of that. So that the heart, you know, if I miss the geographical heartland of our faith, but the home.
Kind of lost in time here, just about what time are we talking about? I mean, I know you keep saying it's not the same as what Jesus confirmed.
No. Well, the difference geographically, the Judaism of the rabbis and the Pharisees in Palestine was a tiny minority of the Jews. You just count heads. It's an important minority. Don't misunderstand me. It was an important minority, but it was a tiny minority.
Well, I know that.
Okay. So what are you asking?
So what period are we talking about when you're describing all these characteristics of the Jews?
First century.
Well, this is when Jesus was there.
Yes.
But he did not. All the ones, I don't understand. And the ones he confronted were just like the Pharisees.
Yeah, well, the Judaism he confronted was dominated by Pharisaic thought. Palestinian Judaism.
Okay.
That we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. See, Jesus never left this area. Now, some of the Jews in that area were Hellenistic. Some of them were Jewish. Especially in Galilee, where Jesus grew up, there were Hellenistic communities. But the majority of the Jews, Judaism, especially around surrounding the temple, and I think the one Jesus ran into was this Jewish law was dominated by what we call Pharisaic Judaism, rabbinic, that form of Judaism which eventually achieved its final expression, the Talmud. Okay. Are you understanding now? As far as the written, in other words, you take two forms of Judaism. There's what we call Palestinian or Rabbinic or Pharisaic Judaism. If you want to go to a body of literature that best expresses that brand of Judaism, you go to the Talmud. We talked about that yesterday. There was Hellenistic Judaism, and we're talking about some of the ways it was different. It was primarily the dispersion all over the world, or as far west as Rome, far east as Babylon into India, into China even, and well down into Africa, to the Ethiopian Eunuch. And if you want to look at a body of writing which best expresses that thought, you look at Philo.
So you're showing how these two types of Judaism coexisted in one
place.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And, right. So and this Hellenistic Judaism, I'm saying is, it's the majority of Judaism. We see it much in the book of Acts. Sometimes I want us to understand what we're looking at, because it's not the same.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that. They sort of pick and chose. It's interesting. I'll give you an example of the difference. Remember up here in Galatia, Paul that Peter, who was a Jew, had learned his lesson at Joppa, and he was going into the houses of Gentiles and eating. Until what? And Paul wished into the face for this. Some Jews came up from Jerusalem. Now the local Jews didn't bother them that much. They went out and do it themselves, but they didn't get all upset. They never make a big stink over it. But these fellows from Jerusalem, see, they were of a rabbinic, they were of the Pharisee tradition. They're the ones who really would kick up a fuss about eating with the Gentiles. The Hellenistic Jews, they wouldn't do it themselves, but they'd get all excited about it. Maybe they would do it. So you found there, you see, it's different, yes.
Was Jesus and his family really kind of considered Hellenistic Jews?
No,
they're
Pharisees. Now, I say Pharisee doesn't mean they followed the Pharisees. It's just the same as that more orthodox, rabbinic kind of Judaism, which we see in the Talmud.
That's right.
Yes, because he didn't. Because that was the most of the Jews he dealt with were that tradition. And Jesus didn't go all the world.
Well, in that location, most of it is the Orthodox. The Orthodox Jews would kind of mix.
No, there's more too many in there. Yeah.
I was told by a Jewish friend that today the I think we've kind of messed this up in our thinking. The Jew today, like in the United States, does not want to have this intermarrying, and they hold it more as a social thing more than the, you know, like you told us, they were intermarrying back and forth. But it seems like today that they're trying to hold on to the nationality or another,
yes,
or race or something.
This is not new to Judaism. They want to preserve their culture, preserve their distinctive qualities. But you see, and they always tell this one, listen to me. But the distinction, in other words, they would say, you can marry with us only if you become one of us. After they said that, they didn't care what a person looked like, did they? And nothing to do with race. That's what I'm saying. The distinction was always the cultural, religio-cultural distinction. It's never what we call it, what we consider to be a racial distinction. They care what you believe, talk about God, and what you look like. Let me see. I've dealt with Christian people all their life who said, well, if one of my children married somebody of a different race, I'd just disown them. And yet, their children marry people who are pagans. And it isn't any bad enough. And my daughter, this is my daughter married a Catholic. And my daughter's married a Mormon, you know. Come to the wedding. Hallelujah. My daughter's getting married. My son's getting married. Well, what kind of faith the first time? I don't know. We got to see our church down today, you know. Their children would marry somebody outside of their race, quote, they just absolutely get a hernia over it. The preachers are called upon, and you go in the ministry, you're going to be called upon all the time to marry the kids in the church, non Christians. With the scriptures expressly forbid. You got no business whatever marrying a Christian or non Christian. They're helping disobey God. That's what it's called prejudice. Make a sense. Yeah, make your presence make a sense. Take a look. This is a place to learn. I don't hurt anybody's feelings, but listen. This old stupidity is going to have to go if we're going to win the next generation of Christ. We've got to get rid of this old remaining thing that's plagued our culture for so long. It's affecting the church. It's got to be done with. The day is far gone when we can have that kind of ignorance attached to the gospel and get the job done. It's been over for a long time. We need to learn it for us. I mean, a priest did it. Now, if you don't agree with me, that's okay. You can amen. Now, they, as we say, they maintained they maintained a,
yeah, and it's important if you don't mind.
As I say, these Jews, very much Jews, who have been Jews for a long time, of all what we call races, they maintained an emotional tie with Jerusalem. We saw this at Pentecost, we see this at the beginning of the other time. The great crowds that came there, that's who these people were for the most part. Now, they, however, Greek was most, for the most part, their first language. Hence, Peter could preach in Greek and everybody understand, or just about everybody. Every Jew of age enough was obligated to pay a half shekel temple tax every year to support the temple, and they did so. And in the various synagogues throughout the Mediterranean world, for instance, they would take this up and they would send a bunch of guards or bodyguards or an escort from men from the synagogue and take it to Jerusalem. And by the way, you see, this was the precedent. This was when Paul took up an offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem, throughout the communities, especially in this area, Macedonia and Achaia, and they all got together and took up this money, and then a bunch of the men escorted it to Jerusalem. This was not a new thing. They've been doing this for years as Jews, taking offering to Jerusalem, which offering consisted of this temple tax.
If
but you see, they had to support many things. They had to support the large temple staff and had to support the general outfit was very expensive. They paid it. A half shekel all that much on an individual, but you have to be accumulated quite a sum. But it was. You see, from all over the world would bring this to Jerusalem.
Why did Paul?
Well, that was not the temple tax. That was for the because of the famine. That was for the church in Jerusalem because of the famine. Not to mention the famine in other countries. That's what I'm talking about. When they took out this offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem, a bunch of them, and they were used to doing this kind of thing, Jews.
Well, that's really then it would be well known that there was a lot of money at the temple then because of all the. So when these men come in and would raid the temple, they knew that was a treasure.
Yes. Regularly. A lot of money there. They had a temple guard. And it may have been this guard that arrested Jesus. Not sure whether it was a Roman guard or a Jewish guard that arrested Jesus. I can't the language, for sure. But it was a temple guard. That was part of their job, was to guard this money, the temple treasury. It's how part of this money came to, was given to Judas to betray Jesus. Plenty of money available. See, the hypocrisy of the Sadducees, the temple, the priestly crowd, they would take the money out to betray a man, but they couldn't come back in. Blood money. Thank you. Well, their main activity in the synagogue was the exposition of the Torah. They adopted many Hellenistic cultural practices. That is, they were Jews, but they were not. No, they were Jews. They kept the basics of the law, or some of the basics of the law. Did not accept these rabbinical traffic. They did not worry about the hedge too much. And sometimes they went too far. For instance, well, a minor custom. When Paul goes to the synagogue, when Jesus goes to the synagogue in Palestine, and opens the scroll and teaches, he sits down. That's the Jewish custom. But when Paul goes to the synagogue, as I mentioned in Acts 13:16, of the dispersion, he stands up to preach. It's a slight difference, but here, after the Greek pattern. Yes.
Were many of these Jews taught that you'd know the head?
Oh, yes, they were aware of it.
So, actually, when they came into worship at the temple, that one trip they made, they watched them carefully.
Yeah, there was a lot of animosity between them and the Jews. I was fighting. The Jews, it was not simply Judaism, they were brand different groups of Jews, but the sex model. Or, you got this? This is a minor difference. The Jewish teacher would always sit down to teach. Jesus would normally sit down to the seashore and talk. But then the Greek would stand up. We follow the Greek pattern. They were more open to Greek social institutions. For instance, Philo, it appears from Philo and other sources that the Jews, for instance, participated in the gymnasium, supported it, took part in Greek life. Many of them did not even practice circumcision. It's interesting. Was Timothy a Jew?
No.
Yes.
Yeah. He is a Jew.
Well, what did Paul have to do to make him at least less offensive to the Jerusalem crowd?
Make
him circumcise. Why? Why wasn't he circumcised as a child? Because, you see, these were Hellenistic Jews. So they believed in the one God, believed in the law, but they went to the gymnasium. They did not necessarily practice circumcision. They didn't keep all the dietary laws. The Mormons have a system called the Jack Mormon. You know what Jack Mormon is? The Jack Mormon is one who believes in Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith's a prophet, believes in the Mormon church, but he smokes cigars and drinks Pepsi. he's a Jack Mormon. He believes in the basics, but he doesn't follow the rules. How does he do for something like that? They ate pork chops in the gymnasium and didn't practice circumcision. They weren't all that, but they believed in the God of Joseph Smith. He believed in the law of Moses. They offer more Hellenistic names. Another name, Paul. Sort of a Hellenistic name, by the way. Saul was a Jewish name. Paul was a Hellenistic name. And many of them, if you go through the, I'm going to take time to do this, and you already know this, if you go through the names in the New Testament, these are Jews, they're Greek names. So they spoke Greek as their first language. They participated in many of the Greek social institutions. They were slack and some of them were considered Jewish customs, like the dietary laws and the circumcision. They wore Greek dress. They were Hellenistic Jews. They practiced a brand new Judaism that was not the kind of Judaism practiced in Latin Palestine by the majority of Jews there. You get the picture? Well, you see, these Jews, by the way, were very much more open to the gospel than would be the Palestinian Jews. They would not have as many prejudices over time. Now don't misunderstand this. The Jews of Palestine regarded these people as Jews. They didn't regard them as very good Jews. Of course, the Jews didn't regard each other as very good Jews. But anyway. Tomorrow I'll make a couple more comments about Hellenistic Judaism, and then I'll get into a discussion of sex of Judaism. It's interesting too, to labor these points, but I wanted to get a mental image, a picture of an active picture of Judaism I'm going to read about.
We're very happy to have on campus today Dr. Wayne Krieger, who's the Executive Director of the State Board of Education.
Thank you. Good morning.
Begin our section on the Jewish sex, religious sex. And we're going to take there are three major Jewish groups, Jewish sects, religious cults. Everybody knows about two of them because they are so prominent in the New Testament, scribes and Pharisees. The Pharisees and Sadducees. We're going to take the one group which is not mentioned of the three to begin with, the Essene. We're going to begin the lecture today, Friday, when we meet, in the class meets next, Dr. Henderson is going to be here. He's going to have the hour, and he's going to show some slides and give a lecture on Qumran. There are two reasons for this. Number one, this would be the appropriate place for it. And also, he's going to show a bit about Masada, although we're not going to talk about Masada until the last week or so of the class. As you see, the select of this settlement, very famous settlement and tourist attraction today in Palestine. And so, since Qumran is generally accepted as being an Essene settlement. And the second reason we're going to have him do it is so you'll retroactive for your senior trip to the Holy Land. Hang in there. Not give up, okay? Now the Essenes, I'm not using the Low Paschal Library translation of Josephus because, for very simple reason, I don't have it. So we're going to use an inferior translation, in my opinion. Josephus writes this: there are three philosophical sects among the Jews, the followers of the first, of whom are the Pharisees, the second, the Sadducees, the third sect, which pretends to a severe discipline, perhaps Josephus was not convinced that they live what they taught, are called Essenes. This, and then we have a lengthy, he mentioned this twice, the three, but this is the only section. If you want this, this reference is Wars of the Jews. In this volume, it's 8-2, Wars 8-2, if you want to read this for yourself. Now, it's not listed that way in the better, the Low Paschal Library translation. It's not given chapter designation, so we listed that one. I'm not going to read all of it. It's quite lengthy. I'll excerpt to give us an introduction to the Essenes. These last are Jews by birth and seem to have a greater affection for one another than the other groups have. They fight among themselves less than the Sadducees and the Pharisees. These Essenes reject pleasures as an evil, but esteem continence and the conquest over our passions to be virtue. There are, and this is called what? What's this attitude or philosophy or approach
to life? Asceticism.
You got the right word, wrong pronunciation.
Asceticism.
They neglect wedlock, but choose out other persons' children while they are pliable and fit for learning, and esteem them to be of their kindred and form them according to their own manners. Interesting parallel, this thing of not marrying or discouraging marriage, and yet raising orphans, or the children of the poor, those who can't afford to raise their children. We see this, by the way, in you might happen to know what 19th century American communal ascetic religious group. We go to around Georgetown, Kentucky, not Georgetown. Yeah, near Georgetown, they still see the buildings of their community. This was the Shakers. You heard of the Shakers? The Shakers did the same thing. They died out pretty hard. If you don't believe in marriage and having children, don't believe in evangelizing, it's pretty hard to keep going. But they did, keep going for a while, but did it mainly by raising orphans. They did a very good job of it, by the way. They absolutely deny the fitness of marriage and the succession of mankind thereby continue, but they guard against the lascivious behavior of women and are persuaded that none of them preserve their fidelity to one man. The philosophy was you can never trust a woman. So sure, they weren't all wrong, but... Well, this is very close to the Greek ideal, that they were very Greek in this. Interesting. The most important work out, and you might want to make note of this, in the studies of Judaism in the intertestamental period in the first century is a work by a man called Hengel, which used to have been translated by 1976 into English, two volume set. To give you an idea how scholarly it is, the first volume is the book, the second volume, which is larger, is the footnotes. But anyway, in Germany, a professor at a major university has to write a second dissertation to keep his job. And this was his second dissertation, and it's a very important first scholarly work. You have to know French and German, and even Greek, really appreciate it, but even in the translation. But anyway, he makes the point in this book that the group which, now you recall that these groups the Pharisees especially, were reacting to the attempt at the Hellenistic reform. Then you have the Maccabean revolt and the Rabbinic Hasidic reaction. Well, he makes the point that these most extreme reactionaries to Hellenism became very Greek in their thinking. Because when they said this about the body, say that holiness equals the abstinence or continence of living free from physical comforts, we're going to talk about that, and avoiding sex wherever possible, whenever possible, or as much as possible, that Plato would have understood this perfectly. Jesus would not have, that Plato would have. This idea is very much a medieval idea. That you are holy to the extent that you rebuke the body. I was telling somebody this, I was reading long ago about a 14th century very famous noble, a chevalier, a knight, and when he died, they took off his armor finally. He must not be seen without his armor. They found out he wore a hair shirt under his armor, scratchy, and he had tied ropes about himself, so tight that with every movement they cut into him, so he was in constant pain. And this was his way, his path to God. He wore that, and so he put his hair shirt on, tied the ropes on, put his armor on, and he'd go out and kill people wholesale. Very interesting approach to life, isn't it? Very interesting concept of spirituality. You kill your enemies, steal, pillage, rob, but rebuke the body. The idea has been around a long time. By the way, Paul rebukes his first stern in the New Testament. And, it's not a lecture on asceticism. Well, see if this idea is a popular idea. It creeps up very ubiquitous as it pops up here and there. Anyway, enough of that. The Essenes, they had no certain city, but they dwelt in it. Many of their sect come from other places. They have what they have lies open for them. This is a new of their own. They were communal. That is, they had a community of property, no private property. They do not allow of the change of garments or of shoes till they be first entirely torn to pieces or worn out by time. They wouldn't buy a new pair of shoes or will buy a new garment until the first one's completely worn out. They make good Bible college to do for them. Nor do they either buy or sell anything to one another, but every one of them gives what he hath to him that wanteth it. I'll read this and receives from him again in lieu of it what may be convenient for himself. Well, he goes on to tell how that they believe in fate and destiny and kismet. That's a very, very deterministic system. They believe they were very secretive. They would not. They took oaths when they entered the group. Moreover, he swears to communicate their doctrines to no one otherwise than as he received them himself. He promises to be honest. Let's see. If anybody's caught in a sin, they cast them out of the society. They are very just in their voting, he points out. He says, moreover, they are stricter than any other of the Jews in resting from their labors on the seventh day. It's hard to imagine anybody being more strict than the Pharisees when it comes to the observance of the Sabbath. But Josephus says they were. Interesting point is that they not only get their food ready the day before that they may not be obliged to kindle a fire on that day, but they will not remove any vessel out of its place. And he also points out that they would not go to the bathroom on the Sabbath. God help your prayer life. Which gives you an idea they were a lunatic fringe, in a way. He does point out that there are, and I'm going to read this because it's important, there is another order of Essenes who agree with the rest as to their way of living and customs and laws, but differ from them at the point of marriage. There was a group of Essenes that did marry. Well, they were a communal group. They were ascetic, isolationist, secretive, highly ethical, a very interesting group. Now, the Essenes are not very important, and yet they are terribly important. The Essenes have, in my opinion, as we call them a historian, the Essenes have been made to be much more important than they are. I've already observed that they're not even mentioned in the New Testament. That they were around, but that with the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, In the caves along the shores of the mountains along the west side of the Jordan River in the 1940s, in 1946, you all know about that. And with the discovery of the Qumran settlement, which has been connected to the Dead Sea Scrolls, that is, the assumption is, and by the way, there's some serious scholars who deny this. It's a minority view, but some of that minority are top-rate scholars. For instance, the Dr. Sandbell at Hebrew Union College recently moved to the University of Chicago. He denies the Dead Sea Scrolls were pre-Christian. And they deny that the Essenes settlement is called it. The people who live in the Essenes and the Qumran are the ones who hid the Dead Sea Scrolls and wrote some of them. That's a minority view, however, and take for what it's worth. But with the assumption, which is the majority assumption, as I've said, that the Essene community is connected to the Dead Sea Scrolls, Well, I've interrupted myself, but what I'm saying is that they have been made important because of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You see, these scrolls are very important for us, for instance, because one of the oldest manuscript evidence that we had of the Old Testament before the Dead Sea Scrolls, what date would you assign to them? What text was it and what date would you assign to them?
Septuagint 250 B.C.?
No, well, that's a translation. They were just a copies of the manuscript in the Hebrew.
Codex Vatican.
Well, right. But what was the date on these manuscripts? The oldest. About 8900. About the 8900. The Masoretic text. They were the oldest that we have. Well, the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it pushed back the evidence roughly 1,000 years. All of a sudden, just bang. And all of the Old Testament manuscripts are there, with the exception of what book in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Esther. With the exception of Esther. Now, and what has been shown is, and this is not a lesson on the text of criticism, but what has been shown is that the Masoretic text is a marvelous text. Extremely reliable. And that the Dead Sea Scroll and the Masoretic text are of a tradition, are of the same scribal tradition as the Dead Sea Scroll text, which means that they have been preserved exceedingly well. And it blew a lot of liberal theories out of the saddle, by the way, concerning the corruption, the alleged corruption of the text. Well, what's important for that reason? It's important because they found a number of their documents, the Damascus document, which tells about the history of the sect and the manual discipline, which gave the rules, the war scroll, which talks about, kind of like the book of Revelation, this eschatological battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And Essenes had a kind of an ontological dualism, that is, light versus darkness, good versus evil, as sort of innate forces innate in the world, in the universe, in nature. The famous temple scroll, the last scroll to be translated by Yadin, the leading star of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Yidniel Yadin, this speaks of the eschatological temple. Part of this reason is, when we talk about the fact that the right of the pure Aaronic or Zadokian high priest line have been lost when Menelaus was put on the throne. Well, remember I said that some of the Jews went to Egypt and built their own temple at Leontopolis? Well, as a part of this general series of events, the Essenes, apparently, this is a deduction, but I think a good deduction, they cut themselves off from temple worship because even though they had the temple in the right place, Jerusalem, they were offering sacrifices, they didn't have the right high priest, therefore they just quit. They just quit the church. And they said, if you don't have the right high priest, we're not going to offer sacrifices. And so then they begin to talk about, for instance, this Zadok, or Zadokian, the Zadok document, the scroll, that talks about the glory of the restoring of the Zadok line of the priesthood. So they can work. And they talk about the Esther, that they could not and would not worship at the temple in Jerusalem. They grow in glowing terms of an eschatological, what does that mean? The end time, eschatological temple. Much after who? Which old Old Testament prophet wrote about a glorified eschatological temple? Oh, come on. The doctor should have frowned upon you. And you sneered. I'll tell him. Let him give me the answer. He had a heap of trouble. Ezekiel. Ezekiel's great temple. We haven't had it yet. Listen, you go ahead and read the rest of the Bible. So they're important because these are because of the antiquity. Listen to me. They're important because of the antiquity of the documents. Because they contain manuscript evidence of the Old Testament. For that reason, they're exceedingly important. But in their own historical context, they're not important at all. Because they were a minority group who went off by themselves, talked to themselves, kept aloof from the general movement of things. They had represented a minority way of thinking. It's like a group that goes off in a corner, builds a fence around itself, and lets the world go by. And I think this is one of the reasons why we do not meet them in the New Testament, although they weren't very much around. You got that to report because their doctrines have been discovered, because they're very old, and for the reasons that I've given. But in their own day, they were not that important. Yes, sir. Oh, sorry, sir. You missed something. It's never happened in my class.
Actually.
Yeah, the Essene community, apparently the Romans, apparently now, remember we studied the fact about AD 65, the Romans actually conquered, as a military takeover by the Romans. Apparently these documents were preserved, were hidden at that time, and sealed in jars, put in caves, their books, which contained their sectarian documents, that is the books of the cult. Like we mentioned, the Zadok, the Temple Scroll, the War Scroll, others. And then the scriptures. Now, so they hid them, and they themselves were killed. Now see, the documents date much older than the community dates only about 160, 165, perhaps later. Some of the documents are older. The Exodus document was back about 250. That is, some of the books were old when they brought them to Qumran. Got that the documents are older than the establishment of the settlement. And we know from coins found at the scene that the settlement existed roughly till the fall of the Palestinian state in AD 66 or 70. Well, anyway, do you all see the distinctions that I'm making between being important historically from our point of view and being important in their own day? Yes?
Is there any spiritual theory that kind of happens?
I'm glad you asked that. Did you hear that question? Good question. Is there any truth to the suggestion that John the Baptist was an Essene? This leads me to what I was going to say next anyway, and that is the second reason why the Dead Sea Scrolls have been important. They have been given an inflated importance. But don't misunderstand. Now, historically, there anything you find that old, and that well-preserved, is important. Out of parenthesis here, there is, as far as primary sources, in the intertestamental period, there's a real dearth of material. That is, there's not much available for a historian has to work with as far as primary sources. So when they found this much primary material, it really rang the bell. However, the fact remains that these fellows were not of critical importance to the history of Palestine in that day. Now, they begin an inflated importance for another reason. I'm going to cover this, although this may be not exactly proper fair for a purely pure history course, but I think you're going to run into this, you need to be aware of it. You realize, don't you, that progressive or liberal or critic theology has as its mecca Tübingen, Germany. You can find a critical, crazy sometimes good. Any new idea in the area of theology, you turn over and look at the bottom and it says made in Germany. No theologian who of the liberal, critical persuasion would ever hold up his head in public until he at least walked across the campus and took Tübingen. Probably took a class. Because these are the boys who are spinning the theories. For instance, at my university, where I did my residence work, In the religion department, their faculty were still teaching German theories that they were laughing at in the history department. Because in the history department, they knew that on the basis of the evidence, these theories had become impossible and had been that way for 45, 50 years. That they had become these German philosophies, these German theories about the New Testament coming and the Old Testament. Were built upon a foundation which had been eroded by the archaeologists back in the turn of the century. But nobody told them in the religion department yet. Really funny that the historians really laughed at the theologians. You follow me? Because they were teaching things that the historians knew that it could not be true. Well, anyway, the one of the assumptions of the, there's a school of thought, it's called Religion Geschichte Lichte, which means a history of a study of the history of religions, or history of religion school of thought, which said this, and been saying so for over 100 years, that John the Baptist and Jesus were products of a pre-Christian, of course, religion or philosophy or movement. It's the old question, the baptism of John, is it from heaven or from men? Well, the Tubingen assumption was it was from men. The problem was, what men? Everybody said there's not much evidence in this period? And so, in the absence of evidence, you speculate. And there's a whole generation of teachers. You go to Chicago University, you go to Yale Divinity, this is Mecca and Medina, and you go to the religion department, you will be taught that John the Baptist and Jesus are products of a pre-Christian, obviously, Palestinian Gnosticism. Now, this, with the translation of such work of such authors written in the 50s and 60s as Rudolf Bultmann and Doucet and Zbarsky and a bunch of others you don't have to remember, bring this into English, then a generation late, you see, the American, Princeton, whatever, generation later, they get finally get around to translating. See, it takes one generation to think up the theories, another translation, another generation to get them into English, another generation to realize they don't have the hell means. In the meantime, you go out of Greersville. I'm serious, there are many theologians whose whole careers have gone right down the drain with the dawn and the progress and growth there, right, and the studies of the general discipline of archaeology. But anyway, And so you have these pace setters, Bultmann and Doucet or Doucet and Reitzenstein, others, who were teaching that that Jesus and John the Baptist got their ideas, got the gospel ultimately, got from this group. Well, who guess who they attributed to? This is before 1940. They attributed to the Essenes. Why? I'll tell you why. First of all, because that's the only group that they knew existed, but they didn't know anything about, except what Josephus said. You see, this is liberal critical methodology. He's like a circle. And by the way, this was explained to me by a PhD from Yale Divinity. This firsthand. Anyway, here's how the system works. You go along, and, like a circle, you got evidence. And you have to stick with the evidence the best you can.
Then you find a gap.
No evidence.
Aha!
Then you go crazy. You come back to the evidence. Along, and all of a sudden there's a gap. And back to the evidence. Well, see, we know it wasn't a Sadducee. He didn't give them, you know, follow me? John the Baptist was not a Sadducee. We knew too much about the Sadducee. It's a sense he wasn't a Pharisee. We knew too much about the Pharisees.
Uh-huh. We got a gap. Guess where?
The Essenes. Along the way they went. John the Baptist and Essenes. Jesus, you know, he's a product of that school of thought. Well, but nobody knew anything about the Essenes. That's a very brief account of Josephus. Lo and behold, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And hooray, now we're going to find the evidence. You see, now keep in mind, I don't mean to be critical, but this is absolutely, if you want to read this, I'm not in the least misrepresenting this. If you go to Yale or Chicago, you're taught that Christianity sprang from pre-Christian Palestinian Gnosticism. There is not one, listen, not one scrap of evidence. Not one scrap of evidence that Gnosticism is pre-Christian at all. In fact, all the evidence is it's post-Christian. The early church fathers viewed it as a Christian heresy. Has it got that? That it grew out of Christianity, rather than Christianity growing out of Gnosticism. Well, anyway, when they found this, they said, now we're going to get the evidence. And so they just really went hog wild. It was the most favorite thing they wrote before. It was writing books about the Dead Sea Scrolls, about the Essenes. And they dug through these, as soon as they get these documents translated, they dug through them to find traces of the beginnings of Christianity. And you can find books that were published in the early 50s after they were found, said, you know, promising. Now we're going to find out what the gospel found. We're going to find out where John got all of his thinking. So they began to translate and examine, and lo and behold, it's like letting the air out of a balloon. And you can, now you've got the latest books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, written by the liberals now, not by conservatives. Here's what you read. Well, what do the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us about Christianity? Answer, little or nothing. Now, there are some diehards. For instance, you can still find people saying, well, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they explain everything. Well, that's the rinky dink. The real scholars admit this. Why? Well, I'll give you an example. There was a figure who emerges in the writings of the sectarian documents, that is, not the scriptures, but the books of the cult itself, which had a figure, prophetic figure, called the Teacher of Righteousness. Got this? Teacher of Righteousness. And it was suggested, when they began to translate these documents, that the Teacher of Righteousness was a type, a forerunner, a prototype of Jesus. That the teaching about that the early church in the second century wrote about Jesus in terms of this Teacher of Righteousness. That's where they got the idea. Follow me? They denied the historical Jesus, but that the real Jesus was this Teacher of Righteousness. What they did was they took the ideas that surrounded this Teacher of Righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in the second and third generation church put them on Jesus. Well, he's the prototype, following. That is, these ideas that the early church had of Jesus, he was the Son of God, he rose from the dead, he did all these things. This came from this Teacher of Righteousness. Well, how does he compare to the Teacher of Righteousness? Well, first place, Jesus founded the church, but the Teacher of Righteousness did not found the group. The Essenes, he came 20 years later. Teacher of Righteousness was a priest on earth, and Jesus was not in the Levitical or Aaronic priesthood. The group, the cult, the Essenes looked for a Messiah, but the Teacher of Righteousness was not him. Got that? They look for a Messiah, but they never identified the Teacher of Righteousness as the Messiah. The Teacher of Righteousness was put to death, but there's no evidence that he was crucified. Although you read many books that say that the Teacher of Righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls and in the document that he was crucified. I can tell you. No, he wasn't. The Bible doesn't say that. So he was put to death. Killed by a wicked priest. There is no indication of a resurrection or a second coming with the Teacher of Righteousness. He just died. The Teacher of Righteousness was a confessed sinner, yet he acknowledged that he was a sinner. Jesus did not. The Teacher of Righteousness vowed hatred to his enemies. What did Jesus say?
Love your enemies.
Love your enemies. The Teacher of Righteousness was monastic. What does that mean?
Secluded.
You know, keep away. Was Jesus? Hardly. The Teacher of Righteousness hated publicans and sinners and wished their death. The Teacher of Righteousness performed no healing miracles. He despised the sick and the needy. The Teacher of Righteousness was not a redeemer in any sense of the term, did not die for the sins of the people. And last of all, the Teacher of Righteousness was extremely legalistic. Of course, other than all these, he was just like Jesus. And you can still pick up books. The public library would say the Teacher of Righteousness is a prototype for Christ.
In what way were they alike? But I want you to see is they learned so very much from the teacher of righteousness to be a prototype of Jesus. Why? Because it already said he was. Well, that is, it already said that you won't, that if the Essenes are the Jesus and John the Baptist came from the Essenes. Well, it's still being taught today by some, but it's a real interesting view. Probably the top scholars are not saying that. In other words, you'll find it in high school, and you'll find it in undergraduate school and college. If you go to a graduate school or first grade university, they know better. As long as you stay out of the religion department. I'm serious about this. If you go to a modern state university, and you go to the religion department, and you study there, you become an anachronism. You go back three generations and study what was thought back then. The day you take your first course, your knowledge becomes outdated. I maintain that a person does not have an education if he learns a whole lot of what isn't true. Anyway, yes.
And this is in the Dead Sea Scrolls about the teacher question?
Yeah, if you want the documents, Underwood, the documents he's found in the Habakkuk commentary and the Damascus document. These are some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of the documents which are part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Habakkuk commentary. These are Pisharim, or commentaries on different books in the Bible. And commentaries. And the commentary on Habakkuk tells about him, and also the Damascus document, which tells about the founding of the cult of the community. Any questions?
So the two main points we're going to remember about the Dead Sea Scrolls are, number one, it proves back the authenticity of the Hebrew Scripture.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Go ahead. And the next one, it excludes the myth that John the Baptist and Jesus were Essenes.
Well, yes. Very true. I say exploded. If you mean nobody's teaching anymore, no. But you see, the idea, Tommy, the idea that the promise did not work out. They simply did not find what they thought they were going to find. Yes. I don't know. It would be younger than the Pharisees. Maybe not the same. Now, there are attempts to link the Qumran community with the early church because, number one, they had a communal meal. When they ate, they all ate together. And they said, aha, that's where the church got the idea of communion. kind of strange than that. By the way, eating together, all peoples of all times have eaten together. And that's very far-fetched. And they point out the fact that the Jerusalem church in its early days practiced their form of communism, communal property, which is not really true, because they did not, the early church did not practice communism. You often hear that the Jerusalem church practiced communism, but that's absurd, of course. They didn't practice communism. They're not living together in the community. They don't have all things common in the sense that nobody owned anything. You know, they give everything to the common pot. They simply, those who had shared with those who had not.
Yeah. How do you spell that? Qumran?
Normal spelling is given a Q because it's a transliteration from Arabic. It's a transliteration from Hebrew to a K. From Aramaic, I mean.
Qumran.
Qumran, are they synonymous with the Essenes?
Yes. Qumran is the name that. When you go take your senior tape, you go to Qumran, and Dr. Henderson's going to show slides of Qumran Friday. The
The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in caves around Qumran. And the group that stood there are generally admitted or considered to be the Essenes. Talk about Josephus. If you don't find a sign in Qumran saying, here lay the Essenes, you know, it's assumed that that's who was there. Because, and we know about the Essenes of Josephus, but that's there. Yeah. Any questions on this? On what basis do we assume that the Qumran community was Essene? Well, number one, Josephus talked about a city in the wilderness near the Dead Sea. In this case, a city in the wilderness near the Dead Sea. Two, Josephus says the Essenes were ascetic, and the documents from the Dead Sea Scrolls picture an ascetic community. Right. We find both in Josephus and in the Dead Sea Scrolls a probation period for initiates. A probation period for initiates. If somebody wants to come into the group, they go there for their own trial. They're at a probation period. Follow me? Read about this in Josephus, about the Essenes. Read about it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. By the Dead Sea Scrolls, they do not call themselves Essenes. Number three, or four, number four, find communism in both. Next, the members were ranked in both, in Josephus and in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Got this? They were ranks or levels. Am I going too fast?
Yeah.
I don't really care, that's what I'd ask you. Communism. Number F, six. Number one, the city of the wilderness, they talk about a city in the wilderness of the Dead Sea, which seems to fit with what we found in Qumran. You find in Josephus' description and in the Dead Sea Scrolls asceticism, the probationary period for initiates, communism, the ranking of members. Next, you find in both sources repeated immersions. Ah, there you see John the Baptist. Repeated immersions. And by the way, almost all religions have this. Follow me? They would have ceremonial washing. Aha, baptism. They go to Hindus, regularly they go to the river, the Ganges River, and jump in. Mission religions regularly have, every religion does it. Christianity is different. Baptism, if it were, is baptism a repeated immersion?
No, then no.
It's not for the reason given either, so that's very strange. Follow me? To argue because they practice repeated immersion, therefore, John the Baptist got his idea about baptism is exceedingly thin. There are certain practices which are cognate, that is, are common to all religions. Repeated communal meals, and eating together in baths, being bathed in oil or water, you know, it is common to almost all religions. Next, they had a common meal, Josephus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Next, I got these alphabetical, I got H. They refused the use of oil, but now that was a cosmetic thing. You know, you would wash and then oil yourself, keep your skin soft. These aesthetics, you might expect, refused to do that. In both Josephus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, they stayed aloof from temple sacrifice. Good test question might be, name five ways in this. Did the name, for our reasons for identifying Qumran at the evidence of Josephus. Next, they had a deterministic theology. I've already mentioned this. Faith and faith, you know, life is determined. Deterministic. You know what that means? Whatever will be deterministic. Awesome. We talked about this with the
Stoics.
And last, they were, in both Josephus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were intolerant of outsiders. Intolerant of outsiders. That's all. But what about disparities now? Why are they kind of different? Yes.
Before you started on transplanting the old church, I got number one and I got
community. The parish community of property. Mm-hmm. On what basis do some suggest that Qumran is not Essene? Well, this minority view I've already mentioned. The Essenes are pictured as practicing celibacy. What Josephus says is that most of the Essenes do not marry, but a few do. What's interesting, that there exists at Qumran a family graveyard. There's a graveyard with women and children in it. Indicating that families live there. Probably indicating that, a normal assumption. But you see, if that's true, then the Essenes were a minor cult, minor division of a minor cult. Or a cult that was less important than the Sadducees and Pharisees. If they were a part of the splinter group that did practice marriage, but that's the interesting thing. If they defined folly, a family graveyard, they were women and children, yes.
Well, they raised orphans and stuff.
They didn't raise women.
They didn't raise little girls, orphan girls?
Well, they would not.
What did they do when they get
grown? Most of the Essenes would not allow women in their midst. According to Josephus, they would not. You know, no women allowed. The second point of disparity is this, that Josephus presents the Essenes as being pacifists. What does that mean? Yeah, against all violence. And yet, the literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls, present a group which is very polemic. It's the opposite of being pacific. It's polemic. What does that mean? Polemos, the war, they were very aggressive. That doesn't seem to fit. This is all the ways when they did fit, but this doesn't seem to fit. However, Josephus does tell about, does say that when the revolt began against the Romans, that the Essenes took part in it. So, maybe they were not as specific as Josephus suggested. Some of them did fight, so that's not a problem right now. But generally speaking, they were regarded as being celibate, yet it seemed that Qumran, there were women and children. Secondly, that's the Qumran literature, assuming that the Dead Sea Scrolls are the books of the Qumran community, very polemic, whereas Josephus presents them as being Pacific. Yes.
Wasn't the Anabaptists
Catholics,
and so they were
pushed
to the
Qumran
community, and
then they had to
move back?
Very good point. At Munster, they were fighting back. Maybe the same kind of thing. Very good point. Well, I've already talked about the implication this has for New Testament studies, which really is nothing. The attempt to link the Essenes with John the Baptist has fallen upon hard times. It's a very beautiful, it's another case, you find time and time again in the study of theology, where a beautiful theory runs aground on the rocks of fact. You know, there's nothing like a few facts to slay a good theory. And the attempts to link them are simple, basically come to that. That is, you got what I'm saying? As I say, not simply by a conservative scholar, but by liberal scholars too, it's generally admitted by those who know what they're talking about. That connection is very tenuous, very strange. not strictly, very uncertain. Anybody who says, now I've heard people say this. Anybody say, well, we know that John the Baptist did come about his ministry. That's a person who does not know what they're talking about. The experts in the field, for the most part, I can put myself by Burroughs, one of the leading scholars. I was in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's what he says. That's the word found. He's not a Christian. This didn't find what we thought we were going to find. Any questions? Well, I'm glad we got through the essence of that, what I wanted to do. So, Friday, I'll not lecture. By the way, we will have to have a look at one session. We're going to cover the Samaritans, and then we're going to have a midterm. Mm-hmm. We're going to cover the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Pharisees. We'll take along the Sadducees and the Pharisees, because we've already done a lot of work with the Pharisees. And so we're going to set us the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Samaritans, and we're going to have a midterm. Okay? Our studies of Qumran, I want to have this study, but I'm not going to get into Qumran anymore, that our time will not permit. I mentioned that the liberal critical German hoped that Qumran would furnish, pointed out, I'm just killing time, that Qumran would furnish some data to support the pre-1946 theories that the Qumran community provides information to the source of the thinking of John the Baptist and Jesus, where they got his ideas of baptism, John the Baptist and identity. This has proved this work. Another I'm not talking about, and I'll just mention this briefly, tied to loose end, as a touch of liberal or critical negative criticism of negative scholarship. The Qumran materials are important, as I said, because they come from an area, an era in which there was prevalent information. You had Josephus, who grew up late in the first century. You had the first and second Maccabees, had a few Jewish papyri. Very little data. There was very commonly held theories, such as that very commonly held theories in this German school of thought was that many of the Psalms were written during this period. They're not written by the days of David, for instance, and shortly thereafter, so forth. And that the book of Daniel came from this period. And that it was based upon David's arguments for literary style, use of words, and so forth. One of the benefits for evangelical scholarship coming from Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is this. That such men as the late William Foxwell Albright, the leading ancient Near Eastern linguist of his day, as he pointed out, that now that we know something about the literary style of that day, before almost nothing was known, but now that we know, we have contemporary, an extensive body of contemporary writing from that period, and we can establish a literary style, he said it's overwhelmingly obvious that the Psalms do not come from that period. And it destroys certain various things from the book of Daniel. And I mention this because in the latest issue, if you want to check on this, the latest issue of the Evangelical, on the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society, the JETS, there's an article on the effect of the studies of Daniel from Qumran. So that it furnished us upon a comparison and it affected liberal critical theories from that viewpoint as well. Well, now that everybody's here and our class already started, let me start the class officially. One more word. This is one of the caves where they found. We're going to cover the Samaritans next in our midterm. You understand that?
Right.
And then he's going to find the most common story of the Arab bloggers looking for some lost goats, and he thought it might be down this cave. It would be like a monkey to get to the cave, just about. And he threw a stone in front of the story. It hurt, you know, plant or whatever, but they just, it's a jar, and he went and found these scrolls. But the Arabs have no sense of antiquity, of the value of antiquity. The Quran discourages archaeology. The Arabs have never had any interest. Their interest in archaeology has come from the West. Just recently, because in Egypt, this last generation, that because of pressure from outside world, because Egypt's so bad, the Egyptians have taken interest in their own antiquities. But in the traditional Orthodox Arab countries, they never have. So they're only concerned, the Arabs' only concern when they see these is the money they can get out of them. And so these begin to appear on the black market, these scrolls, and William Foxwell Albright, who died years ago, identified them as, dated them, and they begin to appear, but if I go into details, some of them were smuggled out of the country, they were American philanthropic money, purchased many of them. Yadin's father got money from the Rockefellers, I think it was, one of the money families needs to buy some of them. It didn't all come from one source. They trickled in as the Arabs, they would surface, and the money had to be paid for them. The Jordanian government was involved in it for long gone out, but the point is that the Arabs, and then as soon as the word got out that there were scrolls in this part of the country, you could sell for a lot of money, then the Arabs themselves began to find there were several hundred caves in that area. And then later on, the great archaeologist, the French priest, his name now. Anyway, he I got a tape of his lectures on the subject. But anyway, he a French priest, led an expedition. They found, among other things, they found a famous copper scroll or treasure scroll. They found a scroll that was copper that did a location of several caches of buried treasure in the area. They located these places the best they could and found no treasure. And there's some real doubt as to whether this treasure scroll is contemporary with the Dead Sea Scrolls and the connection is maybe of its own. But Yadin took over from his father, and as Dr. Henderson mentioned, he is the leading, Yadin is a leading expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well as Masada, so the dean of Palestinian archaeology right now. We have not talked about Herod the Great yet. We have not talked about Masada. We talked about Masada at the end of the year, but I thought it was just having Dr. Henderson come back. So it slides again, so you kind of follow in the back of your mind. We will talk about Masada. One thing I would say about Masada that is important to us.